Pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Tom Eye from North Carolina.
Hi, folks. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic, and delighted to see you. It's a fine-looking crowd, and a good many fairly new people in the program. So I especially want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're anything like me, the period when I came to my first meeting was, without question, the darkest point in my life. Little did I know that I would be stepping into the brightest life I would ever know. So I hope very much that that'll be your experience, just as it's been mine so far. I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And sobriety date is February 2nd of 57. And that's not half as bad as it sounds. I think at one time that would have been my worst dream. I know when I first came in, I was quite young for the fellowship then. I was 24, and there just weren't many 24-year-olds coming off the production line back then. And I never met any for a long time. And people just had an annoying habit of patting young people on the head and telling them how lucky they were to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my God, I felt like I was in a geriatric ward. And I remember one time there was a fella kind of oohing and awing and patting me. And he said, "Do you realize that at your age, you could look forward to as much as 50 years of recovery?" And when he said that, he just looked like Benny Hinn had hit him or something. You know, his eyes just kind of rolled back in his head. And while he was going through the rapture, I was thinking to myself, my God, what if it works? And so I tell you, if you're new here, you either be careful. If you stay too long, man, you'll be here forever. And so get out while you can. You know? No, I tell you, it's the finest thing that ever happened to me, and I'm just deeply grateful for that. I tell you, I want to take a little slant same old story, but I'd like to take a little slant. Particularly owing to the fact that there are a lot of new people here, and I think I can remember those early days. They were vivid enough, and I don't think they've dimmed too much. With you know what it was that brought me from where I was to where I've been for the last 50 years, and so anyway, just on my mind a little bit. I'm a guy who found himself. Yeah, I mean, I knew where I was. I knew the address. But, you know, when the fog lifted and I saw who I was, where I was, what I'd become, I was a 24-year-old guy sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary up in the state of Michigan. In fact, it was the largest walled institution in the entire world. And I was one of 6,000 people just in a sort of legion of the lost, and I was just one more tragic face sitting in that sea of tragic faces, and a 24-year-old guy. And yeah, I could be nice to myself and say that I was there as the result of an unavoidable accident, and I'm sure there would be some truth in that, but that's a little too moderate for what really happened, what brought me there. I was a guy who did what I think every alcoholic in the world has feared doing, and thank God most don't. I was driving blind drunk, blacked out, down the main street of the city of Flint, Michigan, where I was living, and ran down and killed two people whose only mistake was trying to cross the street where I was driving. And so what I'm looking at is a life that by any measure was a bummer. I mean, it was just a loser. And then culminated with the commission of a crime so horrible that there's no adequate punishment for it. There is none. And so that's what I'm looking at when I come out of the fog and take a look at who I am. And I was so full of guilt and shame and remorse that I think if I had any definable kind of an ambition it would have been to just disappear. Yeah, I never believed I would ever go out of that place alive and had no real concern about that. I just wanted to be gone. And when I look at that, and I was in isolation. You know, that isolation is not unusual for alcoholics, and certainly not for me. I was in extreme isolation. They put me in a cell, and I didn't know who was in the cell on either side of me. And it wasn't that I didn't care. They just didn't exist. You know, I was living in almost a cocoon of misery, and I just didn't acknowledge people. I was just totally shut down. And when I look at that, you know, when I look back at that and remember those feelings and remember the total hopelessness of that, you know, the odds of my being here tonight are astronomical. My God, they're astronomical. And it's a phenomenal thing to me that it took something awfully powerful to take that chunk of human wreckage and then give a spark of hope or something that caught on and came to have great meaning. And, you know, I was a guy that when I wasn't just some nice young fella that had a tragic accident on the way to a fraternity party. Yeah, I was a loser. I was an absolute loser. I was somebody that I was a disaster waiting to happen. The marvel is that I didn't do something of that type many, many other times, because my God, I did the behavior many, many, many times. And it's just remarkable that it didn't. When I drove a car on the street, my usual condition, it was like firing a weapon down the street and hoping to hit nobody. And so I was just a disaster waiting to happen. And it wasn't just that. I was a guy that from the time I started drinking, it was bad news. I was somebody, I wasn't born alcoholic, but I drank like it. I drank what the untrained mind would have considered too much. First time I ever drank, I thought it was about right. It was all I could get, and it just seemed to make sense to me. And so I never had any period of what average folk would call social drinking. I just loved what it did to me, fell in love with it. And so I started having serious problems with alcohol before I was alcoholic. You know, I was just a guy who got drunk and did goofy stuff. I went to jail before I was alcoholic, went to hospitals with broken stuff I didn't even know was injured before I was alcoholic. I did a lot of stuff before I was alcoholic. And so when I look back at my life, what I saw was a life that by any measure would have been written off as a total disaster. I'd never held a job for as much as a year in my entire life. Well, it wasn't a long life, but I'd never held for a job for as much as a year. Except the Army, I joined that one time to get away from home, and I didn't want to hold that one for a year. I wanted to quit a lot, and did. But every time I'd quit, they'd hunt me down and put me in jail. And so I finally quit quitting, and they fired me. I was thrown out of the military, 20 years old, unfit for military service, alcoholism. 20 years old. I thought I'd pulled a slick one on the brilliant minds of the U.S. government. They knew what they were talking about. So it was a loser legacy. And that's just one aspect of it. I was the kind of guy who on a given day could look awfully good. If I was sober, I snapped back quickly. I made good appearances. I've always had that sort of a knack for having a favorable reaction from people. You know, when I would go looking for a job, people would hire me for a better job than I was looking for. And they just had a remarkable tendency to overrate me. I've been overrated all of my life. And I go in there wanting to get a job lifting boxes. They put me in charge. I was in charge of 151 people when I was 17 years old. Not very long, but but they were mine while I had them, man. So anyway, it was just that kind of a thing. I couldn't think of a single person in the first 24 years of my life who would not literally have been better off if they had never seen me. Anybody that got close to me got hurt in the process, used, abused, misused, lied to, terrified, disappointed, heartbroken, on and on and on. Anybody who got close to me got dirty in the process. And it wasn't particularly any malicious behavior. It's just the product of a guy who lives like I live. You know, when I first got sober, I thought I didn't hurt my family much because I had the decency to be gone. And then one day it finally occurred to me when I was in the amends process, how much more hurt could you do to a mother than to rob her of a son? You know, most of my life, they didn't even know if I was alive or dead or where I was or whatever. And so how much more injury can you do? And so that was the legacy that I looked at. My current situation, normally they didn't keep a guy like me with my kind of crime. No, not a guy like me, but somebody with a crime like mine. A crime like that is referred to as a casual offense. Now, there's certainly nothing casual about it. But what that means is that it's not premeditated, predicated type of behavior. It's just something that's an outgrowth of a condition. I've never been in any trouble in my life ever, not one single time, that I wasn't drunk. I've never been in trouble sober. Yeah, man, I got into a lot of it drunk. Never been to jail sober. Never have come to in a hospital with my leg broke and didn't even know I'd been hurt. Yeah, caught on sometime. I woke up one time married to a woman I didn't even know. And now I'll assure you that even in Las Vegas, that's a little bit slippery. You can do it quick here. But my God, I did it so quick, I didn't even know I'd done it. I woke up with that lady and I didn't know her. She introduced herself as Mrs. Ivester, and I said, uh-oh. And so here we were. Well, I didn't mean to do that, but the alimony cost just exactly the same. It doesn't matter what the intent. So I was somebody who was a real character. And so that was what my life looked like. And my current situation was in that place I described briefly in the beginning. I'm in the land of the Legion of the Damned. Yeah. And I was with over 6,000 guys locked up in there. I'll guarantee you, if anybody in this group had walked through that population and said, pick out a couple of winners, I'll guarantee you I wouldn't have made that list. I wouldn't have voted for me. Yeah, because I really thought that it was over for me and should be. And that just adds to the magnitude of the miracle. And what I wanted to get at, that you know, if you picture that fellow, you know, a 24-year-old piece of human wreckage that's just barely 24 years old. And I'm sitting in that kind of a condition. I've got a death wish that's unceasing. What would you bet on that? And it's amazing how, you know, my observation has been that most profound things are really simple in their essence. They're really simple, and the things that started to at least introduce the forces that would change my life, I wasn't looking for anything. I'll tell you this before I tell you what happened. If my reaching out for help, or accepting help, or getting into AA, or anything else, had required any initiative from me whatsoever, I would never have done it. Wouldn't have done it. I couldn't have asked for help, for God's sakes. I couldn't have asked anybody for a drink of water. I was so full of unworthiness and guilt and shame and remorse, I couldn't have asked anybody for anything. And what happened? A guy that worked there, a social work type of fellow, called me out for an interview one day. I'd been through many of those things. I could do social histories in my sleep. I'd had so many. Every time somebody captured me, they'd put me through that kind of stuff and then rip off the diagnosis. And this guy was no different. He took me through it, went over my history, made the same startling conclusion that everybody who'd ever looked at me said, and it would always come out like something like, man, you're a bad drunk. You sure drink a lot. You're a problem drinker. You're an alcoholic. I'd heard that stuff ad nauseum. Said the same stuff. Then he said something a little different. He said, man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. And I said, yeah. I mean, I just gave you a little sample of the trouble. Of course I've had a lot of trouble with booze. My God, the Pope would have a lot of trouble with booze if he drank as much as I did. Yeah, you don't have to be an alcoholic. I mean, that's just goofy, drunken behavior. And I said, yeah. And then he said something I'd never heard. He said, we have an AA group here at the institution, and I think you ought to go. Well, I never heard of AA. I never heard of anybody helping a drunk. Now, I mean, this wasn't whale oil days, but it was a long time ago. And AA was not a household name. There were about 125,000 members. I never heard it talked about any place that I hung out. Well, that wouldn't be very likely anyway, even if it was a learned bunch of drunks. They wouldn't have been talking about something like that. But I never heard of it. I never heard of anybody helping a drunk. We didn't have any such thing as detox, you know, where I know that detox is an institution. I don't know of any place in the United States that does work in detox like you guys do in Las Vegas. That is a service project par excellence here. That really good work. Well, they didn't have such stuff. Well, they did, depending on your definition. They had detoxes, but they called them jails. And they were very effective, too, by the way, particularly if they touch up the side of your head with a blackjack on the way in. It tend to have remarkable results. If somebody thinks they can't get sober, try that one time. I'll guarantee you get sober. It may not last long. But, I mean, they didn't have any such thing as that. I never heard of AA. I never heard of anybody helping a drunk when they threw me out of the military for alcoholism. Nobody ever said, man, you ought to get into something or other and do something. It just didn't exist. So I never heard of anything. And so this guy said, when he exclaimed about my drinking problem, he said, we got the AA group. He didn't explain it because I don't think he knew any more than that. I believe somebody told him, when you get a guy in front of you, he's got to file that thick and it's all about booze, tell him he ought to go to AA. Well, now, isn't that a lightweight thing? But would you believe that was the first even hint of a suggestion I'd ever heard? And I've never looked back. Isn't that amazing? That such a simple thing would just sort of gain mo and then wind up with my being an Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't know what he was talking about. He said, AA to me, that didn't have any meaning whatsoever. And I wasn't in the frame of mind for a long conversation. I left. A few days later, he sent me a note, a little slip of paper. It said, you go to your first AA meeting, February 2nd of 57. And I didn't want to go to AA. I mean, I had no clue what it was. I didn't want to go anywhere. People in extreme isolation, I guarantee you the lowest thing on their list of priorities is go out and yuck it up with a bunch of people. There ain't no way. What I wanted to do was sit in that cell and stare at my navel and do anything I could do to keep from thinking is what I wanted to do. So I didn't want to go anywhere. I mean, it wouldn't matter AA or the Kiwanis Club. It would have been the same reaction. And so this guy sent me that note, and I'm so grateful that I was. How am I doing on time? You got those ugly signs you go put on me? Well, I saw what you did to my poor buddy Chuck. I just put the hook on him, and they. But what was I saying? Oh, about the sending slip, and I was blessed, really, truly blessed. With defeat. I mean, I was absolutely, I'm not somebody who intellectually thought this through and said, geez, that sounds like a nice idea. You can thump that up. I'm a guy who was blessed with being beaten totally into submission. I had nothing left. I couldn't even muster a fight. And so when I got that thing, it wasn't an ultimatum. Nobody would have done anything drastic if I hadn't gone. But I was just beaten enough that I just sort of just responded. And was shuffled over to that meeting. Had no clue where I was going. Somebody, I think, had told me that Alcoholics Anonymous was what that AA stood for. And I didn't find that a very attractive name for something to join, Alcoholics Anonymous. You secret drunks. That is not among my aspirations, you know, to be a secret drunk. I wanted to be a very public drunk. And so it was not enticing at all. And I figured it was going to be some kind of a religious deal, and surely enough. Well, I walked into that first meeting. They had an officer on the door, checked my name, and said, go sit down. And I sat down. Well, now, let me tell you what happened. And I think the major thing I wanted to just sort of share with particular interest in folks that may be trying to get launched in this program. I was a guy who was absolutely devoid of any motivation whatsoever. I mean, I was like whipping a noodle. Man, there was nothing. There was no response. I was a dead man walking. So I had no real eagerness or zeal or angst about needing to do something. I just wanted to be gone. And I'm sitting in that meeting simply because I didn't have the means to resist. And when I think about what I've just given you a little snapshot of, the odds against a guy like that recovering are unbelievable. Unbelievable. And I'll tell you just a few of the things that just come to mind when I think about formidable barriers that I faced, and some of you may be facing, formidable barriers that really make getting into recovery a major challenge. One, I was young. You know, 24 was incredibly young for 1957. I was the youngest member in that group, in that entire penitentiary. I was the youngest member in every meeting I attended for several years. When I was released and went back to North Carolina, I was the youngest member in the entire state. Started the first young people's group. Now, being young, in retrospect, ain't a bad deal. But it's a little bit of baggage when you're sitting in something called Alcoholics Anonymous and you're the youngest cat in the barn. And so I remember that burden of the barrier of youth, because you know, we can talk about identification rather than comparison all we want to. But I'll guarantee you, if you're sitting between two people who outweigh you by 25 years of drinking, you're going to compare, and you're going to come up short. And that's what I did. Even though I'd had a horrible kind of a life, I felt wimpy when I'd sit in there. And listening to people tell these goofy war stories had no real impact on me. I mean, I hear somebody tell me he'd been blind drunk for 40 years and never sobered up. Well, my God, I hadn't drunk but 8 years. And now I'm trying to identify with that. You know, I puke 10 feet straight in the air, never get any on me. It's very commendable. It didn't mean much to me. But you know what I'm talking about? That thing of this, just these Wild West things. I've been married 8 times to the same woman. It's unbelievable. So I couldn't identify with people. I mean, everybody I saw seemed different than me. And they were different. I'm sitting there, I'm the young guy. It's like a guy pat me on the head and said, "Boy, you can make 50 years. I said, "Oh, God. Oh, no." Yeah, scary thought. So that you. You know, I know that nothing like this ever comes in the pure minds of people in Las Vegas, but let me just risk it anyway that you might understand it. There's a thing that happens. I won't get too deep into this because I'll get it over my head. But there's a thing that happens in the course of alcoholism. Men, I don't know what women do, but men go through a period where they just kind of lose their vitality in one important area of life. And when you first sober up, there's more than a little concern, particularly with a guy like me, about is this a permanent condition? Now, I mean, I didn't have any immediate anxiety about an active sex life because I'm in there with 6,000 guys, and I'm the youngest, cutest thing in that penitentiary. And so I figured if there was any sexual activity, I didn't know which end of it I'm going to be on. So I wasn't real keen about just jumping in real quick with restoration in that area. But, you know, there may be a day, you know. You never know about that. And so the good news is that while it may go away dependably, it does tend to come back. Well, anyway, that's but, I mean, that's the thing when you're young. You know, I'm thinking, you know, as I'm starting to contemplate if I do live, where in the world do sober people find a girlfriend? I mean, I never had found them anywhere except dives where I hung out. And I thought, where do sober people go? What do? Go down to the Baptist church at an ice cream social, hit on somebody? I mean, that just didn't seem like it would register real well. So I had a lot of concerns about that kind of stuff. You guys probably never considered any of that, but I sure did. And so as a young guy, that was there because you know that if you happen to unfortunately live, it's going to be a long, slow ride, and I'll never smile again. And that's sort of what was on my mind. So youth is not a real springboard to sobriety. It's a challenge for a guy like me. What do you do for a social life? You know, and those were very, very real things. So it's a barrier to be able to think beyond it. I was extremely ignorant about alcoholism. I knew nothing about alcoholism. Now, when I came in, I knew this much about it. It was a moral issue. I came in just about the time the American Medical Association kind of nodded toward alcoholism as being like an illness. They never did declare it an illness, but they just kind of gave friendly eyes to it and said, this is like an illness. You know, that was just enough to start cracking doors that had been previously closed to that. But I was ignorant of that. It was a moral condition to the society. It was a moral condition to me. When I heard about alcoholics talking about it being an illness, a disease, I found that an awkward, almost embarrassing kind of a consideration. I thought, what on earth is an illness about getting drunk? It made no sense to me. I was totally ignorant about that. I was filled, as you can well imagine, another barrier. I was filled with an overwhelming sense of unworthiness. When I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, everybody in the room seemed 2 feet higher than me in decency and humanity and worth. And I'm talking about guys in the world's largest maximum custody penitentiary. Everybody in there seemed like spiritual giants compared to me. And so I had an overwhelming sense of unworthiness because I look back on a life that I gave you just a quick snapshot of, and that is literally my life. And so I'm looking at a life like that and then culminated with such a crime as mine. You can imagine the sense of unworthiness. I wasn't even sure. Another huge barrier was I wasn't even sure I wanted to live. You know, people talk about being wanting to live sober. I wasn't sure I wanted to live. When I started to think, because the guilt was so heavy that I just teetered back and forth between an unwillingness to live and maybe a little bit of daylight. But that was a teetering balance for me. The guilt that was associated with that was enormous. And so there was a real, real set of formidable barriers that had nothing to do with whether I could stay sober one day. It had to do with whether I could muster enough spirit to even enter the fight. And so it was a huge kind of a thing to get into the ready position in this program. I'll always be grateful for that. There were a lot of forces that had impact on that. The people who came into that institution, Luther was talking about going to that jail. For God's sakes, go. When I think back to the things that really had meaning to me, there were a number of things. One was the people who came in from the outside. The recovery group, that'd always be my home group. That was the group I went into there. It was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way we ran, 1 week we would break into step groups. We took over the entire school building. And we'd break up. We had 300 members, and we would break up into primarily step discussions. And then the other week we'd have outside speakers who were invited by us. Now, you were invited by Luther this time, but in that place, you know, later on after I got into the program, it became my job to invite speakers. Now, that's a little bit difficult when you don't know anybody that calls themselves AA. You know, but if you search it long enough, you'll find somebody. I'll tell you something. If you do institutional work, I'll just give you one clue that you may want to think about a little bit. I'm one of the guys who had a transforming experience in that institution. I mean a transforming experience. I left there a different man because I had a program to live by. And when I caught on to what was happening and I watched those people come in, I would sit and literally, I wouldn't let anybody see it, but I would literally cry inward with gratitude that somebody cared enough to even come in there and stick out a friendly hand. I genuinely appreciated that. But I was in the group for over a year before I ever spoke to one of them. Couldn't bring myself to do it. So you may just want to keep that in mind if you do some institutional work. The real glib slick talker that's so ready to communicate may not be where you want to spend your time. You may want to look out a little bit for the one who's hanging back. You can spot it. Excuse me. If you look for it. And then, you know, that was a huge barrier in itself. But what a powerful thing that was to have that hand of hope that came in there. And that'll always be extremely, extremely important to me. I have the great privilege now of, and have many times over the years, but one of my mentors is still living. He's a guy named Mel, and lives up in Toledo, Ohio. And Mel spoke at my fifth meeting of AA. He was the first person I ever heard put words to how I felt. Now, I didn't get religion from hearing it, but boy, I never forgot it. Never forgot it. Because it started to articulate all of that mess that I was about. He and I are dear friends now. Yeah, we do workshops together someday. You imagine how that feels? For me, that grubworm sitting there in the middle of that 300, and now one of my mentors, a powerful figure. He and I are co-workers. Great, great stuff. So there were a lot of things that came through. The fact that the recovery group was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm a group man. We are absolutely replete with just sort of lightweight meetings in this country, but I'm a group man. I'm somebody who believes very much in strong, purposeful groups. I'm very much somebody who believes in the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous being at play in a group. I'm somebody who believes, now this is just my own personal biases, no, they're not biases, they're beliefs, but I'm somebody who believes that a recovery that doesn't have an active service life is a recovery that's shortchanged. That what that does is it sort of lets me get at the survival level, but it doesn't get through to the joy level, to the real zest for living. You know, I'm somebody who truly believes that the key to real joy and happiness and strength and recovery is in service, not in spending your life studying the book and learning 400 ways to pronounce powerless. Yeah, I think those steps in the book are about launching me into a program of action. I believe any group, I was real pleased to hear those announcements about service here, because I believe any group that doesn't have a service life outside the meeting is a group that's shortchanged. And so I believe that because that's what I grew up with. And so in that group, I got introduced to a strong, purposeful group that did service. Now, nobody ever asked me if I wanted to join it or anything like that. Somehow or other, you just sort of have a knack for spotting people who've got a little hunger, I guess, or desperation or something. And so the guys in that group just kind of, that'll happen in a group, you know, as opposed to a meeting. You know, meetings can often be just a gathering of strangers. But in a group, you'll have that kind of an ethic where you'll spot people who either need a little boost into something or got some energy at this channel. But it'll happen. And so that's what happened to me. Nobody ever said you want to get involved in service. They'd just say, hey, Tom, come on, go with us. I said, where are you going? I said, don't worry about it. Just come on. And so that's how I got introduced. And I've never known any other thing. And I'll tell you this. Here I am 50 years later, and I'm nobody special. But I'll tell you this. I am just as active in Alcoholics Anonymous as I was 50 years ago. I'm just as dynamically involved, just as creative. My mind is just as active as it ever was. I'm having as much fun as I've ever had. I'm doing more work and plowing new fields than I've ever done. And you know, there's some people will tell you, I'm not one of them, but some people will tell you that AA runs a fairly predictable cycle, that you'll come in and then you'll sort of go through the labors that I was talking about. Then you'll sort of catch it, and you'll be on a honeymoon, a pink cloud phase. And then at some predictable point, that'll deteriorate, I guess, into mediocrity or something. I don't know what it is because I never have experienced it. What I believe is that's not predictable. That's just flat wrong. What I believe is that that period of pure joy that we call the honeymoon or the pink cloud, that lasts exactly as long as I do the stuff that puts me there and not one more second. The minute I quit, that's the minute I start slumping. And so I'm somebody that I'm very much, you'd say I'm involved in Alcoholics Anonymous would be the understatement of the century. I'm the most active guy I've ever seen, except for Daryl on the cell phone. That man has got to, I swear to God, I get dizzy listening to him answering the phone. Anyway, that's a whole ball of wax and service itself. But those are things that started to happen. Those were just the mechanics of getting involved in a strong, purposeful group. Starting to feel a sense of belonging instead of being isolated. Starting to feel a sense of stuff. I rushed through, and I'm going to have to rush through the rest of this, because where's the girl with the signs? Somebody's going to clobber me for a long. Okay. Let me just tell you a little bit about now. That's what you know, sort of got me into that, catching the energy of just getting in, helping somebody pick up something. It's called unity and starting to feel a sense of belonging. Yeah, when somebody new comes in, I don't like to hand them a book. I like to hand them a broom. Hey, come on in and help with the chairs. You know, help me pick up this podium. I can lift it by myself. But something happens when you start helping and start joining in and being a part of. And so that's what I've been talking about. But let me tell you about the staying power right quick. You know, I was a guy, I was just what I described. I was a guy that where there should have been a spiritual life for me, there was a cold, empty place. Since before I started school, I backed away from anything that had to do with religion. I found that stuff confusing, made me feel guilty, it scared me. And I just, as a child, said, man, I'm just not going there. And so I backed out of it. As soon as I got big enough to escape the clutches of mother, I didn't go anymore. And I never went back until I was sober 11 years before I ever went back into a church. I'm not talking about a mild case. I'm talking about a total resistance. And so when I walked into that meeting, I sort of suspected it was going to be some kind of a religious frenzy or a Jim Jones Kool-Aid session or something. And so I was a little nervous about that whole business. And so when I walked in, first thing they did was pray. Serenity prayer. Short little old prayer, but powerful. And while they were praying, I was saying to myself, yep, I knew it. They'll be out here in a minute with the snakes and drums, and then here we go. And so I was not into that. And so that was how I got started. They read a bunch of stuff, like we did here tonight, only more. God knows they read a bunch of stuff. And that sounded like scripture to me. And then they introduced the speaker. He was the wildest man. I tell you, I'd heard people in DTs make more sense than he sounded like he was making to me. Now, all he's doing is the same thing I'm doing. But now mine sounds remarkably sane. Of course, I'm not listening to it. But I listened to that man, and I thought, why on earth is he telling that god-awful story? You know, here's 300 hairy-legged convicts just drinking up every word, except me. And I'm sitting there thinking, this fool is nuts. And I couldn't figure out why would he do it. And I left that meeting totally confused. And then the amazing thing, I was back the next week. That guy, by the way, became my first sponsor. A year later, I wouldn't speak to him for a year, but he became my first sponsor. And I loved him better than Peter loved the Lord. Great guy. He was a delegate for the state of Michigan the day he made that talk. And so I started getting that kind of fumbling hold. I went through the God of logic and reason and, you know, all of the sort of rational thinking about Spire. And logically it made sense that spring follows winter and, you know, and so on. Yeah, I mean, I could see that in trees grow and that this kind of stuff. I mean, I could do that. But that's a fairly limited thing, but it was a starting place where I at least started to acknowledge there's something. Even though I didn't understand what it was, I started to put some thinking to it. And then a major turning point occurred for me, and it was the fourth step. was a place where I really had a defining place, a moment in AA. I didn't intend to take the fourth step, but I went to a meeting one day, and a guy spent the entire meeting, outside speaker, spent the entire meeting talking about the inventory. And when he got through, I went back to my cell, and I said, okay, I'm going to do that. And I'd been thinking about how such a nice fellow as me got in such a mess, is really what I was thinking about. And I meant to write a little sad story about what a victim of circumstances I was, and I really wasn't that kind of guy. Yeah, it's what I meant to write. But the founders were wise when they said, write the inventory. Because if I'm just thinking about it, my God, I can convince myself of anything. But if I say it out loud, it sounds stupid. And if you write it down, it looks stupid. And so I wasn't thinking about all that. I just said, I'm going to do it. And I sat down, took the old legal pad, wrote down two lines of what I had in mind. And then, without any intent whatsoever, and it wasn't high drama or anything, but all at once, I just stopped. And it was not a clap of thunder, the skies opened up, or anything like that. I think I saw the charade of my life for the first time in clear focus. That illusion that had been my very life, that delusion that kept me from being able to see things in reality, I think the skies parted and I saw it. And in one motion, and I'm talking 5 seconds, I'm not talking about a long, anguishing process. In 5 seconds, I just stopped that thing and then skipped to the next line and opened up and just sort of poured out my heart. That's all. It wasn't any skillful inventory. It wasn't one you'd want to publish as a model. But I'll tell you this. It is the finest day's work I have ever done in my life. And I mean the finest. Finer than the day I got out of prison. Finer than the day I graduated from college, started my career in an unbelievable profession, finished it. Greater than the day I married my wife, who's dealt with me for 39 years, when my children were born. Everything in my life suspends from that fact that happened with that inventory. Because when I got through with that, I knew with no question at a cellular level that I am beat. I am beat. I'm an alcoholic. Not a bad drinker, not the tragic case or the whiz kid or any of that stuff or the real alcoholic. I knew I was an alcoholic. I have this illness. There's something about me. I don't need to understand it profoundly. But there's something about me, if I take a drink, I cannot predict what I'll do. God only knows, because I don't. That day, there'd been a good war, but it was over. And this boy admitted total, complete surrender. In the third chapter of our book, there's a little line that says, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves. You know, I told you I'm an alcoholic. That's got nothing to do with conceding. That's communication. That's saying I'm an alcoholic. That's where I'm coming from. That's all that is. Conceding meant that deep down where I live, where nobody knows but me, I accepted the fact that, man, I am beat. And the deal for me is I'm somebody that can't drink. I'm not somebody who decided I'm not going to. I can't. That war was over. And all these years later, it has never resumed for one millisecond. Not one. I have never had a doubt. That war was over. What I'm left with is a mind of an alcoholic. And then the rest of the steps, I won't have time to go through. I'll just simply say that was a huge point. That was the fulcrum of it in my recovery. Where I became purposeful. Started to open the door on defects of character that there was something drastically out of whack with me. You know, I first thought when I heard defects of character, I thought that meant my behavior, what I'd done. And then when I started to understand a little bit deeper that defects of character are what drives the behavior. What is it that makes me operate in such a strange way? What is it that makes it so difficult for me to have real relationships with people without some kind of an underlying junk going on? What is that? What is it that causes my mind to turn irresistibly to the thought of a drink? You know, those are defects of character. That's not behavior. They're the things that are out of whack in my life that drive me in a strange way. And not drinking does not make those go away. The rest of the steps do. You know, 6 and 7 is about the decision. Do I really want to get well or don't I? Simple. Very simple. I'm either ready to get well or I'm not. Decision time. And if I'm ready, then the step says we humbly ask him to remove them. I'm not somebody who believes they're snatched away like a lobotomy. I'm somebody who believes that the defects yield to the actions of the next steps. When I do 8 and 9, I start to make right the wrongs. I go back to those people that I used and abused and mistreated and right those wrongs. I won't have time to talk about it, but I'll be here till Sunday. And even in a case like where I caused the deaths of 2 people and the families that remained, I was able to make full and direct amends to everybody involved. There's a powerful program here. If anybody's hung up with some amends you just don't think you can tackle, look me up. I'm at the Riviera, and somebody knows what room I'm in. I don't. I hope I can find it when I get over there. But anyway, Riviera. My name is Ivester, Ivester. I'll be anonymous to the newspaper, but I want you to know who I am. I'm Tom Ivester. And so you feel free to get in touch. I'll be hanging out with that bunch of old people at the internet. Anyway, I don't know how I get mixed up with these old crafts all weekend. But that's powerful. You know, I'm somebody who believes, I'll just offer this as kind of a just lightly veiled editorial comment. I'm somebody who believes that I will never be a free man until I go back and right all those wrongs. I'm somebody who firmly believes that those wrongs that go in and become a part of my soul, they don't die of old age. And you don't perish them by lack of fertilizing them with booze. They don't go anywhere. What they do is just hang there and nibble away at my life on a regular basis. And I will never be free till I go back and make those things right. My God, how many people I meet in conferences around the world who come to me and say, I've lived in torture for 25 years because I've never been able to handle this, whatever it is, and stay harpooned on that kind of thing. And the surgery's there. And that's where that freedom comes, the joy of how to be free. I had the great privilege, one of the few values of being old, of meeting our founder. And listening to him describe what I'm playing with here a little bit, where he talked about this aspect of a program, and he said the real outcome of this program is not to give us some kind of a hidden place to go talk with people with a problem. The real outcome of this program is to restore me to my rightful place in this world. And if I do what's laid out in these steps, I will be restored. There'll come a day when I can walk the face of this earth on any street and look any person I meet dead in the eye. Man, I'm telling you, I was about that far from the ground when he said that, and I thought, God knows, man, that's a fantasy. Today I can tell you, there's not a place on earth that I know of that I can't comfortably walk and look any human I meet in the eye. Got nothing to hide. Bill said that I could say to anybody, and I'll say to anybody, ask me anything you want to ask. I have got no secrets. That's freedom. That's where the freedom comes from. And being dry for 80 years doesn't cause that. It's from dealing with those defects and making right those wrongs and becoming free. And then the last part of the program that I'll finish up on is I won't be able to tell you about getting out and being rich and famous and the movie will be out for I'll tell the rest some other time. But anyway, yeah, that is the freedom. Yeah, that is the freedom. And I became a free man in a maximum custody penitentiary. Now, if you don't think this is a powerful program, you weigh that. I became free. I lived for the first time in my life with dignity and honor and purpose and self-esteem and worth when I was locked up like a wild animal. the transforming experience. And then when I was released, went back to North Carolina. I had to grow up to be able to find my place. And so I got immediately active. I was a bit active there. The best thing I know to deal with transition, I know a lot of people make transition in and out of Las Vegas. The best way I know to deal with transition is to be solid as a rock in the program. Then transition is a no-brainer. I mean, my God, all you do is take the energy and just transfer it to another place. You know, it's no big deal. And so it was a big deal for me to walk out of prison when they told me I could go if I'd go to North Carolina. But it was not a big deal in the terms of knowing what I would do, because I was already set. Man, all I did was move right into a town and got up to my neck in alligators. Man, I was having a ball. And I've been active that whole time. There hasn't been a period. I had one time when I'd moved. Well, every time I moved to a new town, I always have a little bit of trouble. But I'm somebody who really wants a high-powered group. I'm not somebody who wants a coffee clutch. And so every time I've moved, I've wound up having to start a group. You know, our book describes that pretty well, that you create the fellowship you crave. If it ain't there, build it. And so that's what I've been doing. I've been as active as anybody I know. And I'll just tell you this to wrap up what I'm talking about. And that's nothing heroic. I hope you don't hear anything in that like that. It's not heroic. I truly believe I'm the most rewarded, most fortunate man on the face of this earth. And I'm not somebody who believes, you know, most people I hear talk about burnout never have been on fire. You know, they just sort of burn on the way to the starting blocks, you know. And that I don't buy the concept, you know. I mean, I know you can get tired of something and all that stuff, but what I've learned is that when I am dynamically involved of being of service, I don't get tired. I get pumped. I'll give you one example, and I guess if I've got any kind of a recruiting pitch here, it's that if you're not having a ball in AA, if you're not absolutely on fire, for God's sakes, don't treat this thing like a tennis match. Man, jump in this thing and get it. You only got one shot at this deal. And for God, don't just sit there and let that thing blithely go away. I'll tell you the example. I was in state I travel a lot, and I was in state, and the guys knew it. So everybody I knew owed something to called me about the same time. And from Thursday till Sunday, I had an unusual schedule. Everything everybody said, it was only one half of my state, but it covered the whole half of the state. You know, somebody called me from this town, we want you to do this, will you do this over here, do this. Well, at the end of it, I was kind of puzzled about something. From Thursday to Sunday, I drove a little over 2,000 miles and spoke for a total of 12 and a half hours. And the last one, I finished up on Sunday night in Cary, North Carolina, the high-tech capital of the world, the new, what do they call it, Silicon Valley. Yeah, it's a real nice community, a nice bunch of nice people. When I finished up, I slid into that parking lot at 8 o'clock. Now, after 2,000 miles and 11 and a half hours, I had more energy than I had when I started. Because I'm not telling you something that I think. I'm telling you something I know. I'm 74 years old. Oh, God. That just sounds awful. But it feels good. Yeah, and I am having an absolute ball. If you're not, for God's sakes, jump in this thing, man. Give it everything you got. Thanks.